for which she'd had no time while Strike had been in St. Maur's, because the other four cases on the agency's books were absorbing all working hours. Robin hadn't been out since her birthday drinks with Isla and Vanessa, which hadn't been as enjoyable as she'd hoped. The conversation had revolved entirely around relationships, because Vanessa had arrived with a brand new engagement ring on her finger. Since then, Robin had used pressure of work during Strike's absence to avoid nights out with either of her friends. Her cousin Katie's words, "It's like you're travelling in a different direction to the rest of us," were hard to forget. But the truth was that Robin didn't want to stand in a bar while Isla and Vanessa encouraged her to respond to the advances of some over-familiar, Morris-like man with a line in easy patter and bad jokes. She and Strike had now divided between them the people they wished to trace and re-interview in the Bamborough case. Unfortunately, Robin now knew that at least four of her allocated people had passed beyond the reach of questioning. After careful cross-referencing of old records, Robin had managed to identify the Willie Lomax who'd been the long-serving handyman of St. James's Church, Clerkenwell. He died in 1989, and Robin had so far been unable to find a single confirmed relative. Albert Shimmings, the florist and possible driver of the speeding van seen on the night of Margot's disappearance, had also passed away, but Robin had emailed two men she believed to be his sons. She'd sincerely hoped she'd correctly identified them, otherwise an insurance agent and a driving instructor were both about to get truly mystifying messages. Neither had yet responded to her request to talk to them. Wilma Bayliss, the ex-practice cleaner, had died in 2003. A mother of two sons and three daughters, she'd divorced Jules Bayliss in 1975. By the time she died, Wilma hadn't been a cleaner, but a social worker, and she'd raised a high-achieving family, including an architect, a paramedic, a teacher, another social worker, and a labour councillor. One of the sons now lived in Germany, but Robin nevertheless included him in the emails and Facebook messages she sent out to all five siblings. There'd been no response so far. Dorothy Oakden, the practice secretary, had been 91 when she died in a North London nursing home. Robin hadn't yet managed to trace Carl, her only child. Meanwhile, Margot's ex-boyfriend Paul Satchwell and the receptionist Gloria Conti were proving strangely and similarly elusive. At first, Robin had been relieved when she'd failed to find a death certificate for either of them. But after combing telephone directories, census records, county court judgments, marriage and divorce certificates, press archives, social media, and lists of company staff, she'd come up with nothing. The only possible explanations Robin could think of were changes of name, in Gloria's case possibly by marriage, and emigration. As for Mandy White, the schoolgirl who'd claimed to have seen Margot at a rainy window, there were so many Amanda Whites of approximately the right age to be found online that Robin was starting to despair of ever finding the right one. Robin found this line of inquiry particularly frustrating, firstly, because there was a good chance that White was no longer Mandy's surname, and secondly, because, like the police before her, Robin thought it highly unlikely that Mandy had actually seen Margot at the window that night. Having examined and discounted the Facebook accounts of another six Amanda Whites, Robin yawned, stretched, and decided she was owed a break. Setting her laptop down on a side table, she swung her legs carefully off the sofa so as not to disturb Wolfgang, and crossed the open plan area that combined kitchen, dining and living rooms to make herself one of the low-calorie hot chocolates she was trying to convince herself was a treat, because she was still, in the middle of this long, sedentary stretch of surveillance, trying to keep an eye on her waistline. As she stirred the unappetizing powder into boiling water, a whiff of tuberose mingled with the scent of synthetic caramel. In spite of her bath, fracas still lingered in her hair and on her pyjamas. This perfume, she'd finally decided, had been a costly mistake. Living in a dense cloud of tuberose made her feel not only perpetually on the verge of a headache, but also as though she were wearing fur and pearls in broad daylight. Robin's mobile, which was lying on the sofa beside Wolfgang, rang as she picked up her laptop again. Startled from his sleep, the disgruntled dog rose on arthritic legs. Robin lifted him to safety before picking up her phone and seeing, to her disappointment, that it wasn't Strike, but Morris. "Hi, Sol." Ever since the birthday kiss, Robin had tried to keep her manner on the colder side of professional when dealing with Morris.
"Hey, Robs. You said to call if I had anything, even if it was late."
"Yes, of course." "I never said you could call me Robs, though."
"What's happened?" asked Robin, looking around for a pen. "I got Gemma drunk tonight. Shifty's PA, you know. Under the influence. She told me she thinks Shifty's got something on his boss."
"Well, that's hardly news," thought Robin, abandoning the fruitless search for a writing implement.
"What makes her think so?" "Apparently he said stuff to her like, 'Oh, we'll always take my calls, don't worry,' and 'I know where all the bodies are buried.'"
An image of a cross of St. John slid across Robin's mind and was dismissed.
"As a joke," Morris added. "He passed it off like he was joking, but it made Gemma think."
"But she doesn't know any details."
"No, but listen, seriously, give me a bit more time, and I reckon I'll be able to persuade her to wear a wire for us. Not to blow my own horn here, can't reach for one thing. No, seriously," he said, although Robin hadn't laughed. "I've got her properly softened up. Just give me a bit more time.
Look, I'm sorry, Saul, but we went over this at the meeting," Robin reminded Morris, suppressing a yawn which made her eyes water. "The client doesn't want us to tell any of the employees we're investigating this, so we can't tell her who you are. Pressuring her to investigate her own boss is asking her to risk her job. It also risks blowing the whole case if she decides to tell him what's going on."
"But again, not to toot—"
"So, it's one thing her confiding in you when she's drunk," said Robin. Why wasn't he listening? They'd been through this endlessly at the team meeting. "It's another asking a girl with no investigative training to work for us."
"She's all over me, Robin," said Morris earnestly. "It'd be crazy not to use her."
Robin suddenly wondered whether Morris had slept with a girl. Strike had been quite clear that that wasn't to happen. She sank back down on the sofa. Her copy of The Demon of Paradise Park was warm, she noticed, from the dachshund lying on it. The displaced Wolfgang was now gazing at Robin from under the dining table with the sad, reproachful eyes of an old man. "Sol, I really think it's time for Hutchins to take over, to see what he can do with Shifty himself," said Robin.
"Okay, but before we make that decision, let me ring Strike and—"
"You're not ringing Strike," said Robin, her temper rising. "His aunt's— he's got enough on his plate in Cornwall."
"You're so sweet," said Morris, with a little laugh. "But I promise you, Strike would want a say in this.
He left me in charge," said Robin, anger rising now, "and I'm telling you, you've taken it as far as you can with that girl. She doesn't know anything useful, and trying to push her further could backfire badly on this agency. I'm asking you to give it up now, please. You can take over on postcard tomorrow night, and I'll tell Andy to get to work on Shifty." There was a pause.
"I've upset you, haven't I?" said Morris.
"No, you haven't upset me," said Robin. After all, upset wasn't quite the same as enrage.
"I didn't want to—"
"You haven't, Saul. I'm only reminding you what we agreed at the meeting."
"Okay," he said. "All right. Hey, listen. Did you hear about the boss who told his secretary the company was in trouble?"
"No," said Robin, through clenched teeth.
"He said, 'I'm going to have to lay you or jack off.' She said, 'Well, you'll have to jack off because I've got headache.'"
"Ha ha," said Robin. "Night, Saul." Why did I say ha-ha? She asked herself furiously, as she set down her mobile. Why didn't I just say, stop telling me crap jokes, or say nothing? And why did I say sorry when I was asking him to do what we all agreed at the meeting? Why am I cosseting him? She thought of all those times she pretended with Matthew. Faking orgasms had been nothing compared to pretending to find him funny and interesting through all those twice-told tales of rugby club jokes, through every anecdote designed to show him as the cleverest or the funniest man in the room. Why do we do it? She asked herself, picking up The Demon of Paradise Park without considering what she was doing. Why do we work so hard to keep the peace, to keep them happy? Because, suggested the seven ghostly black-and-white faces behind Dennis Creed's, they can turn nasty, Robin. You know just how nasty they can turn, with your scar up your arm and your memory of that gorilla mask.
But she knew that wasn't why she'd humoured Morris, not really. She didn't expect him to become abusive or violent if she refused to laugh at his stupid jokes. No, this was something else. The only girl in a family of boys, Robin had been raised, she knew, to keep everyone happy, in spite of the fact that her own mother had been quite the woman's libber. Nobody had meant to do it, but she'd realised during the therapy she'd undertaken, after the attack that had left her forearm forever scarred, that her family role had been that of easy child, the non-complainer, the conciliator. She'd been born just a year before Martin, who had been the Ellicott's problem child, the most scattered and impetuous, the least academic and conscientious, the son who still lived at home at 28, and the brother with whom she had least in common. Though Martin had punched Matthew on the nose on her wedding day, and the last time she'd been home, she'd found herself hugging him when he offered, on hearing how difficult Matthew was being about the divorce, to do it again. Wintry specks of rain were dotting the window behind the dining table. Wolfgang was fast asleep again. Robin couldn't face perusing the social media accounts of another 50 Amanda Whites tonight. As she picked up the Demon of Paradise Park, she hesitated. She'd made a rule for herself, because it had been a long, hard journey to reach the place where she was now, and she didn't want to lose her current good state of mental health, not to read this book after dark, or right before bed. After all, the information it contained could be found summarised online. There was no need to hear in his own words what Creed had done to each of the women he'd tortured and killed. Nevertheless, she picked up her hot chocolate, opened the book to the page she had marked with a Tesco receipt, and began to read at the point she'd left off 3 days previously. Convinced that Bamborough had fallen victim to the serial killer, now dubbed the Essex Butcher, Talbot made enemies among his colleagues with what they felt was his obsessive focus on one theory. "They called it early retirement," said a colleague, "but it was basically dismissal. They said he wasn't interested in anything other than the butcher, but here we are, 9 years on, and no one's ever found a better explanation, have they?" Margot Bamborough's family failed to positively identify any of the unclaimed jewellery and underwear found in Creed's basement flat when he was arrested in 1976, although Bamborough's husband, Dr. Roy Phipps, thought a tarnished silver locket, which had been crushed, possibly by blunt force, might have resembled one that the doctor was believed to have been wearing when she disappeared. However, a recent published account of Bamborough's life, Whatever Happened to Margot Bamborough, written by the son of a close friend of the doctor, contains revelations about the doctor's private life, which suggests a new line of inquiry and a possible connection with Creed. Shortly before her disappearance, Margot Bamborough booked herself into the Bride Street Nursing Home in Islington, a private facility which in 1974 provided discreet abortions. Chapter 16. Behold the man, and tell me, Britomart, if I more goodly creature thou didst see, how like a giant in each manly part bears he himself with portly majesty. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. 4 days later, at 5:15 in the morning, the Night Riviera sleeper train pulled into Paddington Station. Strike, who'd slept poorly, had spent long stretches of the night watching the ghostly grey blur of the so-called English Riviera slide past his compartment window. Having slept on top of the covers with his prosthesis still attached, he turned down the proffered breakfast on its plastic tray and was among the first passengers to disembark into the station, kit bag over his shoulder. There was a nip of frost in the early morning air, and Strike's breath rose in a cloud before him as he walked down the platform, Brunel's steel arches curving above him like the ribs of a blue whale's skeleton, cold dark sky visible through the glass ceiling. Unshaven, and slightly uncomfortable on the stump that had missed its usual nightly application of soothing cream, Strike headed for a bench, sat down,
lit a much-needed cigarette, pulled out his mobile, and phoned Robin. He knew she'd be awake, because she'd just spent the night parked in Strike's BMW, outside the house of the weatherman, watching for postcard. They'd communicated mostly by text while he'd been in Cornwall, while he divided his time between the hospital in Truro and the house in St. Mawes, taking it in turns with Lucy to sit with Joan, whose hair had now fallen out and whose immune system appeared to have collapsed under the weight of the chemotherapy, and to minister to Ted, who was barely eating. Before returning to London, Strike had cooked a large batch of curry, which he left in the freezer, alongside shepherd's pies made by Lucy. When he raised his cigarette to his mouth, he could still smell a trace of cumin on his fingers, and if he concentrated, he could conjure up the deadly smell of hospital disinfectant underlain with a trace of urine, instead of cold iron, diesel, and distant waftings of coffee from a nearby Starbucks. "Hi," said Robin. And at the sound of her voice, Strike felt, as he had known he would, a slight easing of the knot of tension in his stomach. "What's happened?"
"Nothing," he said, slightly surprised, before he recollected that it was 5:30 in the morning. "Oh, yeah, sorry. This isn't an emergency call. I've just got off the sleeper. Wondered whether you fancied getting breakfast before you head home to bed."
"Oh, that'd be wonderful," said Robin, with such genuine pleasure that Strike felt a little less tired. "Because I've got Bamborough news."
"Great," said Strike. "So have I. Be good to have a catch-up."
"How's Joan?"
"Not great. They let her go home yesterday. They've assigned her a Macmillan nurse. Ted's really low. Lucy's still down there."
"You could have stayed," said Robin. "We can cope."
"It's fine," he said, screwing his eyes up against his own smoke.
A shaft of wintry sunlight burst through a break in the clouds and illuminated the fag butts on the tiled floor.
"I've told him I'll go back for Christmas. Where do you want to meet?"
"Well, I was planning to go to the National Portrait Gallery before I went home, so..."
"You were what?" said Strike.
"Planning to go to the National Portrait Gallery. I'll explain when I see you. Would you mind if we meet somewhere near there?"
"I can get anywhere," said Strike. "I'm right by the tube. I'll head that way, and whoever finds a cafe first can text the other."
45 minutes later, Robin entered Notes Cafe, which lay on St. Martin's Lane and was already crowded, though it was so early in the morning. Wooden tables, some of them as large as the one in her parents' kitchen in Yorkshire, were crammed with young people with laptops and businessmen grabbing breakfast before work. As she queued at the long counter, she tried to ignore the various pastries and cakes spread out beneath it. She'd taken sandwiches with her to her overnight surveillance of the weatherman's house, and those, she told herself sternly, ought to suffice. Having ordered a cappuccino, she headed for the back of the cafe, where Strike sat reading the Times beneath an iron chandelier that resembled a large spider. She seemed to have forgotten over the previous 6 days how large he was. Hunched over the newspaper, he reminded her of a black bear. Stubble thick on his face, tucking into a bacon and egg ciabatta roll, and Robin felt a wave of liking simply for the way he looked. Or perhaps, she thought, she was merely reacting against clean-jawed, slim, and conventionally handsome men who, like tuberose perfumes, seemed attractive until prolonged exposure made you crave escape. "Hi," she said, sliding into the seat opposite him. Strike looked up, and in that moment, her long shining hair and her aura of good health acted upon him like an antidote to the fug of clinical decay in which he had spent the 5 days.
"You don't look knackered enough to have been up all night."
"I'll take that as a compliment and not as an accusation," said Robin, eyebrows raised. "I was up all night, and postcard still hasn't shown herself, or himself. But another card came yesterday, addressed to the television studio. It said postcard loved the way he smiled at the end of Tuesday's weather report." Strike grunted. Robin said, "Do you want to go first on Bamborough, or shall I?"
"You first," said Strike, still chewing. "I'm starving."
"Okay," said Robin. "Well, I've got good news and bad. The bad news is nearly everyone I've been trying to trace is dead, and the rest might as well be. She filled Strike in on the deceased status of Willie Lomax, Albert Shimmings, Wilma Bayliss, and Dorothy Oakden, and on the steps she'd taken, so far, to contact their relatives. Nobody's got back in touch except one of Shimmings' sons, who seems worried that we're journalists trying to pin Margot's disappearance on his father. I've written a reassuring email back. Hope it works. Strike, who had paused in his steady demolition of the roll to drink half a mug of tea, said,
"I'd been having similar problems. That two women struggling by the phone boxes sighting is going to be nigh on impossible to check. Ruby Elliott, who saw them, and the Fleury mother and daughter, who almost certainly were them, are all dead as well. But they've both got living descendants, so I fired off a few messages. Only one response so far, from a Fleury grandson who doesn't know what the hell I'm talking about. And Dr. Brenner doesn't seem to have a single living relative that I can see. Never married, no kids, and a dead sister who didn't marry either."
"Do you know how many women there are out there called Amanda White?" sighed Robin.
"I can imagine," said Strike, taking another large bite of roll. "That's why I gave her to you."
"You?
I'm kidding," he said, smirking at her expression. "What about Paul Satchwell and Gloria Conti?"
"Well, if they're dead, they didn't die in the UK. But here's something really weird. I can't find a single mention of either of them after 75.
"Coincidence?" said Strike, raising his eyebrows. "Douthwaite, he of the stress, headaches, and the dead mistress, has disappeared as well. He's either abroad or he's changed his identity. Can't find any address for him after 76, and no death certificate either. Mind you, if I were in his shoes, I might have changed my name as well. His press reviews weren't good, were they? Crap at his job, sleeping with a colleague's wife, sending flowers to a woman who then disappears.
We don't know it was flowers," said Robin, into her coffee cup. "Other kind of presents are available, Strike."
"Chocolates, then, same applies. Harder to see why Satchwell and Conti took themselves off the radar, though," said Strike, running his hand over his unshaven chin. "The press interest in them died away fairly fast, and you'd have found Conti online if it was a simple case of a married name. There can't be as many Gloria Contis as there are Amanda Whites."
"I've been wondering whether she went to live in Italy," said Robin. "Her dad's first name was Ricardo. She could have had relatives there. I've sent off a few Facebook inquiries to some Contis, but the only people who've responded so far don't know a Gloria. I'm pretending I'm doing genealogical research, because I'm worried she might not respond if I mention Margot straight off."
"I think you're probably right," said Strike, adding more sugar to his tea. "Yeah, Italy's a good idea. She was young, might have fancied a change of scene. Satchwell disappearing's odd, though. That photo didn't suggest a shy man. You'd think he'd have popped up somewhere by now, advertising his paintings.
I've checked art exhibitions, auctions, galleries. It really is as though he dematerialized."
"Well, I've made some progress," said Strike,
swallowing the last mouthful of his roll and pulling out his notebook.
"You can get a surprising amount of work done sitting around in a hospital. I found four living witnesses, and one of them's already agreed to talk. Gregory Talbot, son of Bill, who went off his rocker and drew pentagrams all over the case file. I explained who I am and who hired me, and Gregory's quite amenable to a chat. I'm going over there on Saturday if you want to come."
"I can't," said Robin, disappointed. "Morris and Andy have both got family stuff on. Barclay and I have got to cover the weekend."
"Ah," said Strike. "Shame." "Well, I've also found two of the women who work with Margot at the practice," said Strike, turning a page in his notebook. "The nurse, Janice, is still going by her first married name, which helped. The address Gupta gave me was an old one, but I traced her from there. She's now in Nightingale Grove."
"Very appropriate," said Robin,
"in Hither Green.
And Irene Bull's now Mrs. Irene Hickson, widow of a man who ran a successful building contractors. She's living in Circus Street, Greenwich."
"Have you phoned them?"
"I decided to write first," said Strike. "Older women, both living alone.
I've set out who we are and who's hired us, so they've got time to check us out. Make sure we're kosher. Maybe check with Anna.
Good thinking, said Robin.
And I'm going to do the same with Una Kennedy, the woman waiting for Margot in the pub that night, once I'm sure I've got the right one. Anna said she was in Wolverhampton, but the woman I found is in Alnwick. She's the right age, but she's a retired vicar.
Robin grinned at Strike's expression, which was a mixture of suspicion and distaste.
What's wrong with vicars?
Nothing, he said,
adding a moment later,
much. Depends on the vicar. But Una was a bunny girl back in the '60s. She was standing beside Margot in one of the pictures the press used, named in one of the captions. Don't you think the transition from bunny girl to vicar is fairly unlikely?
Interesting life trajectory, Robin admitted. But you're speaking to a temporary secretary who became a full-time detective. And speaking of Una, she added, drawing her copy of The Demon of Paradise Park out of her handbag and opening it, I wanted to show you something. There, she said, holding it out to him. Read the bit I've marked with pencil.
I've already read the whole book, said Strike. Which bit,
please? Robin insisted. Just read where I've marked.
Strike wiped his hand on a paper napkin, took the book from Robin, and read the paragraphs next to which she had made a thick pencil line. Shortly before her disappearance, Margot Bamborough booked herself into the Bride Street nursing home in Islington, a private facility which in 1974 provided discreet abortions. The Bride Street nursing home closed its doors in 1978, and no records exist to show whether Bamborough had the procedure. However, the possibility that she allowed a friend to use her name is mooted by the author of Whatever Happened to Margot Bamborough, who notes that the Irish woman and fellow bunny girl Bamborough was supposedly meeting in the pub that night might have had good reason for maintaining the pub story, even after Bamborough's death. Bride Street Nursing Home lay a mere 8 minutes' walk from Dennis Creed's basement flat on Liverpool Road. The possibility remains, therefore, that Margot Bamborough never intended to go to the pub that night, that she told the lie to protect herself or another woman, and that she may have been abducted, not from a street in Clerkenwell, but a short distance from Creed's house near Paradise Park.
What the... began Strike, looking thunderstruck. My copy hasn't got this bit. You've got an extra 3 paragraphs.
I thought you hadn't read it, said Robin, sounding satisfied. Yours can't be a first edition. Mine is. Look here, she said, flicking to a place at the back of the book, while Strike still held it. See there, the endnote. Whatever Happened to Margot Bamborough, by C.B. Ogden, published 1985.
Except it wasn't published, said Robin. It was pulped. The author of this, she said, tapping The Demon of Paradise Park, must have got hold of an advance copy. I've been digging, Robin went on. All this happened pre-internet, obviously, but I found a couple of mentions of it online, in legal articles about suing for libel to stop publication. Basically, Roy Phipps and Una Kennedy brought a joint action against C.B. Ogden and won. Ogden's book was pulped, and there was a hasty reprint of The Demon of Paradise Park without the offending passage.
C.B. Ogden, repeated Strike.
Is he Dorothy the practice secretary's son, exactly? Full name, Carl Bryce Ogden. The last address I've got for him was in Walthamstow, but he's moved, and I haven't managed to track him down yet.
Strike reread the paragraphs relating to the abortion clinic, then said,
Well, if Phipps and Kennedy succeeded in suing to stop publication, they must have convinced a judge that this was partly or completely false.
Horrible thing to lie about, isn't it? Said Robin. Bad enough if he was saying Margot had the abortion, but hinting that Una had it and was covering up where Margot was that night.
I'm surprised he got it past lawyers, said Strike.
Ogden's publisher was a small press, said Robin. I looked them up too. They went out of business not long after he had his book pulped. Maybe they didn't bother with lawyers.
More fool them, said Strike. But unless they had some kind of death wish, this can't have been entirely invented. He must have had something to base it on. And this bloke, he held up the demon of Paradise Park, was a proper investigative journalist. He wouldn't have theorized without seeing some proof.
Can we check with him, or is he
dead? Said Strike, who sat for a moment, thinking, then went on. The appointment must have been made in Margot's name. The question is whether she had the procedure or whether somebody used her name without her knowing.
Strike reread the first few lines of the passage.
And the date of the appointment isn't given either. Shortly before her disappearance. Weasel words. If the appointment had been made for the day she disappeared, the author would say so. That'd be a major revelation, and it had been investigated by the police. Shortly before her disappearance is open to wide interpretation.
Coincidence, though, isn't it? Said Robin. Her making an appointment so close to Creed's house?
Yeah, said Strike.
But after a moment's consideration, he said,
I don't know, is it? How many abortion clinics were there in London in 1974?
Handing the book back to Robin, he continued,
This might explain why Roy Phipps was jumpy about his daughter talking to Una Kennedy. He didn't want her telling his teenage daughter her mother might have aborted her sibling.
I thought of that too, said Robin. It'd be an awful thing to hear, especially when she's lived most of her life wondering whether her mother ran out on her.
We should try and get hold of a copy of Whatever Happened to Margot Bamborough, said Strike. They might still be copies in existence if they got as far as printing them. He could have given some away. Review copies and the like.
I'm already on it, said Robin. I've emailed a few different second-hand book places. This wasn't the first time she had found herself doing something for the agency that made her feel grubby. Carl Ogden was only 14 when Margot disappeared, she continued. Writing a book about her, milking the connection, claiming Margot and his mother were close friends.
Yeah. He sounds a commoner garden shit, Strike agreed. When did he leave his address in Walthamstow?
5 years ago.
Had a look on social media?
Yes. Can't find him. Strike's mobile vibrated in his pocket. Robin thought she saw a flicker of panic in his face as he fumbled to find it and knew that he was thinking of Joan. Everything all right? She asked, watching his expression darken as he looked down at his mobile screen. Strike had just seen. Bruv, can we please talk this over face to face? The launch and the new album are a big deal for Dad. All we're asking...
Yeah, fine, he said,
stuffing the phone back in his pocket, the rest of the message unread.
So you wanted to go to...
For a moment, he couldn't remember the unlikely place Robin had told him she wanted to visit, and which was the reason they were currently sitting in this particular cafe. The National Portrait Gallery, she said. Three of Postcard's postcards were bought in their gift shop.
Three of... Sorry, what?
He was distracted by what he'd just read. He'd been quite clear with his half-brother that he had no wish either to attend the party celebrating his father's new album, or to feature in the photograph with his half-siblings, which was to be their congratulatory gift to him. Postcards, postcards. The person who's persecuting our weatherman, she reminded him, before mumbling, It doesn't matter, it was just an idea I had.
Which was?
Well, the last but one picture Postcard sent was of a portrait they said always reminded them of our weatherman. So I thought, maybe they see that painting a lot. Maybe they work at the gallery. Maybe they secretly want him to know that, to come looking for them. Even as she said it, she thought the theory sounded far-fetched. But the truth was that they had absolutely no leads on Postcard. He or she had failed to turn up at the weatherman's house since they'd been watching it. Three postcards bought in a single place might mean something, or perhaps nothing at all. What else did they have? Strike grunted, unsure whether this indicated a lack of enthusiasm for her theory about Postcard. Robin returned her copy of The Demon of Paradise Park to her handbag and said,
Heading for the office after this?
Yeah. I told Barclay I'd take over watching Twinkle Toes at 2.
Strike yawned.
Might try and get a couple of hours' kip first.
He pushed himself into a standing position.
I'll call you and let you know how I get on with Gregory Talbot. And thanks for holding the fort while I was away. Really appreciate it.
No problem, said Robin.
Strike hoisted his kit bag onto his shoulder and limped out of the cafe. With a slight feeling of anticlimax, Robin watched him pause outside the window to light a cigarette, then walk out of sight. Checking her watch, Robin saw that there was still an hour and a half before the National Portrait Gallery opened. There were doubtless more pleasurable ways of whiling away that time than in wondering whether the text that Strike had just received had come from Charlotte Campbell. But that was the distraction that occurred to Robin, and it occupied her for a surprising portion of the time she had left to kill.
Chapter 17. But thou, whom frowning froward fate hath made sad witness of thy father's fall.
Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen. Johnny Rokeby, who'd been almost entirely absent from his eldest son's life, had nevertheless been a constant, intangible presence, especially during Strike's childhood. Parents' friends had owned his father's albums, had Rokeby's poster on their bedroom walls as teenagers, and regaled Strike with their fond memories of Deadbeat's concerts. A mother at the school gate had once begged the 7-year-old Strike to take a letter from her to his father. His mother had burned it later, at the squat where they were then staying. Until he joined the army, where, by his choice, nobody knew either his father's name or his profession, Strike regularly found himself contemplated like a specimen in a jar, bothered by questions that under normal circumstances would be considered personal and intrusive, and dealing with unspoken assumptions that had their roots in envy and spite. Rokeby had demanded Lay to take a paternity test before he'd accept that Strike was his son. When the test came back positive, a financial settlement had been reached which ought to have ensured that his young son would never again have to sleep on a dirty mattress in a room shared with near strangers. However, a combination of his mother's profligacy and her regular disputes with Rokeby's representatives had merely ensured that Strike's life became a series of confusing bouts of affluence that usually ended in abrupt descents back into chaos and squalor. Leda was prone to giving her children wildly extravagant treats, which they enjoyed while wearing two small shoes, and to taking off on trips to the continent or to America to see her favourite bands in concert, leaving her children with Ted and Joan while she rode around in chauffeured cars and stayed in the best hotels. He could still remember lying in the spare room in Cornwall, Lucy asleep in the twin bed beside him, listening to his mother and Joan arguing downstairs, because the children had arrived back at their aunt and uncle's in the middle of winter, without coats. Strike had twice been enrolled in private schools, but later had both times pulled him out again before he'd completed more than a couple of terms, because she decided that her son was being taught the wrong values. Every month, Rokeby's money melted away on handouts to friends and boyfriends, and in reckless ventures. Strike remembered a jewellery business, an arts magazine, and a vegetarian restaurant, all of which failed, not to mention the commune in Norfolk that had been the worst experience of his young life. Finally, Rokeby's lawyers, to whom the rock star had delegated all matters concerning the well-being of his son, tied up the paternity payments in such a way that Leda could no longer fritter the money away. The only difference this made to the teenage Strike's day-to-day life had been that the treats had stopped because Leda wasn't prepared to have her spending scrutinised in the manner demanded by the new arrangement. From that point onwards, the paternity payments had sat accumulating quietly in an account, and the family had survived on the smaller financial contributions made by Lucy's father. Strike had only met his father twice, and had unhappy memories of both encounters. For his part, Rokeby had never asked why Strike's money remained unspent. A tax exile of long standing, he had a band to front, several homes to maintain, two exes and a current wife to keep happy, five legitimate and two illegitimate children. Strike,
whose conception had been an accident, whose positive paternity test had broken up Rokeby's second marriage, and whose whereabouts were usually uncertain, came low on his list of priorities. Strike's uncle had provided the model of manhood to which Strike had aspired through his mother's many changes of lover, and a childhood spent in the long shadow cast by his biological father. Leda had always blamed Ted, the ex-military policeman, for Strike's unnatural interest in the army and investigation. Speaking from the middle of a blue haze of cannabis smoke, she would earnestly attempt to dissuade her son from a career in the army, lecturing him on Britain's shameful military history, on the inextricable links between imperialism and capitalism, and trying, without success, to persuade him to learn the guitar, or at the very least, to let his hair grow. Yet with all the disadvantages and pain they had brought, Strike knew that the peculiar circumstances of his birth and upbringing had given him a head start as an investigator. He'd learned early how to colour himself according to his environment. Before the loss of a leg had hampered his full range of physical movement, he'd been able, in spite of his distinctive size, to move and talk in ways that made him appear smaller than he really was. He'd also learned the value of concealing personal information and of editing the stories you told about yourself to avoid becoming entangled in other people's notions of who you must be. Most importantly of all, Strike had developed a sensitive radar for the changes in behaviour that marked the sudden realisation that he was a famous man's son. He'd been wise to the ways of manipulators, flatterers, liars, chancers and hypocrites ever since he was a child. These dubious gifts were the best his father had given him, for, apart from child support, there'd never been a birthday card or a Christmas present. It had taken his leg being blown off in Afghanistan for Rokeby to send Strike a handwritten note. Strike had asked Charlotte, who had been sitting next to his hospital bed when he received it, to put it in the bin. Since Strike had become of interest to the newspapers in his own right, Rokeby had made further tentative attempts to reconnect with his estranged son, going so far as to suggest in recent interviews that they were on good terms. Several of Strike's friends had sent him links to a recent online interview with Rokeby, in which he'd spoken of his pride in Strike. The detective had deleted the messages without a response. Strike was grudgingly fond of Al, the half-brother whom Rokeby had recently used as an emissary. Al's dogged pursuit of a relationship with Strike had been maintained in spite of his older brother's initial resistance. Al appeared to admire in Strike those qualities of self-reliance and independence that the latter had had no choice but to develop. Nevertheless, Al was showing an antagonizing bullheadedness in continuing to push Strike into celebrating an anniversary which meant nothing to Strike, except in serving as yet another reminder of how much more important Rokeby's band had always been to him than his illegitimate son. The detective resented the time he spent on Saturday morning grafting a response to Al's latest text message on the subject. He finally chose brevity over further argument. "Haven't changed my mind, but no hard feelings or bitterness this end. Hope all goes well, and let's get a beer when you're next in town." Having taken care of this irksome bit of personal business, Strike made himself a sandwich, put on a clean shirt over his T-shirt, extracted from the Bamborough case file the page on which Bill Talbot had written his cryptic message in Pitman's shorthand, and set off by car for West Wickham, where he had an appointment with Gregory Talbot, son of the late Bill. Driving through intermittent sun and rain, and smoking as he went, Strike refocused his mind on business, mulling not only the questions he planned to ask the policeman's son, but also the various concerns related to the agency that had arisen since his return. Certain issues that needed his personal attention had been raised by Barclay the previous day. The Scot, whose Strike was inclined to rate as his best investigator after Robin, had firstly expressed himself with characteristic bluntness on the subject of the West End dancer on whom they were supposed to be finding dirt.
"We're not going to get anything on him, Strike, if he's shagging some other bird. She must be living in his fucking wardrobe. I ken he wi' old lassie for a credit card, but he's too smart to fuck up a good thing.
"'Think you're probably right,' said Strike. "'But I said we give the client 3 months, so we keep going. "'How you getting on with Pat?' he added. "'He was hoping that somebody else found the new secretary "'as much of a pain in the arse as he did, but was disappointed. "'Aye, she's great. "'I ken she sounds like a bronchial docker, but she's very efficient. "'But if we're having an honest talk about new hires here,' Barclay said, "'his large blue eyes looking up at his boss from under thick brows. "'Go on,' said Strike. "'Morris not pulling his weight? "'I wouldn't see that exactly.' "'The Glaswegian scratched the back of his prematurely grey head, then said, "'Robin not mentioned anything to you?' "'Has there been trouble between them?' asked Strike, more sharply. "'Not to say trouble, exactly.' said Barclay slowly. But he doesn't like taking orders from her. Makes that plain behind her back.
Well, that'll have to change. I'll have a word.
And he's got his own ideas about the Shifty case.
Is that right? Said Strike.
He still thinks she's going to win over the PA. Robin told him it was time to let it go, time to put Hutchins in. She's found out.
That Shifty belongs to Hendon Rifle Club, yeah, she emailed me. And she wants to get Hutchins in there to try and befriend him. Smart plan. Shifty fancies himself a bit of a macho man, from all we know about him.
But Morris wants to do it his way. He said to her face he was happy with the new plan, but...
You think he's still seeing the PA?
Seeing might be a polite way of putting it, said Barclay. So Strike had called Morris into the office and laid it down in plain language that he was to leave Shifty's PA alone and concentrate for the next week on Two Times Girlfriend. Morris had raised no objections. Indeed, his capitulation had been tinged with obsequiousness. The encounter had left a slightly unpleasant aftertaste. Morris was, in nearly all respects, a desirable hire, with many good contacts in the force. But there had been something in his manner as he hurried to agree that denoted a slipperiness Strike couldn't like. Later that night, while Strike was following the taxi containing Twinkletoes and his girlfriend through the West End, he remembered Dr. Gupta's interlaced fingers and the old doctor's verdict that what made a successful business was the smooth functioning of a team. Entering West Wickham, he found rows of suburban houses with bay windows, broad drives, and private gardens. The avenue, where Gregory Talbot lived, was lined with solid family residences that spoke of conscientious middle-class owners who mowed their lawns and remembered bin day. The houses weren't as palatial as the detached houses on Dr. Gupta Street, but were many times more spacious than Strike's attic flat over the office. Turning into Talbot's Drive, Strike parked his BMW behind a skip that blocked the front of the garage. As he switched off his engine, a pale, entirely bald man with large ears and steel-rimmed glasses opened his door, looking cautiously excited. Strike knew from his online research that Gregory Talbot was a hospital administrator. "Mr. Strike," he called, while the detective was getting carefully out of the BMW. The drive was slick with rain, and the memory of tripping on the Falmouth ferry still fresh.
"That's me," said Strike, closing his door, and holding out his hand as Talbot came walking towards him.
Talbot was shorter than Strike by a good 6 inches.
"Sorry about the skip," he said. "We're doing a loft conversion."
As they approached the front door, a pair of twin girls, Strike guessed to be around 10 years old, came bursting outside, almost knocking Gregory aside.
"Stay in the garden, girls," called Gregory,
though Strike thought the more pressing problem was surely that they had bare feet and that the ground was cold and wet.
"Stay in the garden, girls,"
imitated one of the twins. Gregory looked mildly over the top of his glasses at the twins.
"Rudeness isn't funny."
"It bloody is,"
said the first twin, to the raucous laughter of the second.
"Swear at me again, and there'll be no chocolate pudding for you tonight, Jada," said Gregory, "nor will you borrow my iPad."
Jada pulled a grotesque face, but did not, in fact, swear again.
"We foster,"
Gregory told Strike as they stepped inside.
"Our own kids have left home. Through to the right and have a seat."
To Strike,
who lived in a slightly Spartan minimalism by choice, the cluttered and very untidy room was unappealing. He wanted to accept Gregory's invitation to sit down, but there was no way he could do so without having to first shift a large quantity of objects which felt rude. Oblivious to Strike's plight, Gregory glanced through the window at the twins. They were already running back indoors, shivering.
"They learn," he said,
as the front door slammed and the twins ran upstairs. Turning back to face the room, he became aware that none of the seats were currently usable.
"Oh, yeah, sorry," he said,
though with none of the embarrassment that Strike's Aunt Joan would have displayed had a casual visitor found her house in this state of disorder.
"The girls were in here this morning."
Gregory swiftly cleared a leaking bubble gun, two naked Barbie dolls, a child's sock, a number of small bits of brightly coloured plastic and half a Satsuma off the seat of an armchair to allow Strike to sit down. He dumped the homeless objects onto a wooden coffee table that was already piled high with magazines, a jumble of remote controls, several letters and empty envelopes and further small plastic toys, including a good deal of Lego.
"Tea?" he offered. "Coffee? My wife's taken the boys swimming." "Oh, there are boys too."
"Hence the loft conversion," said Gregory. "Darren's been with us nearly 5 years." While Gregory fetched hot drinks, Strike picked up the official sticker album of this year's Champions League, which he'd spotted lying on the floor beneath the coffee table. He turned the pages with a feeling of nostalgia for the days when he, too, had collected football stickers. He was idly pondering Arsenal's chances of winning the cup when a series of crashes directly overhead, which made the pendant light sway very slightly, made him look up. It sounded as though the twins were jumping on and off their bed. Setting the sticker book down, he pondered, without finding an answer, the question of what could have motivated Talbot and his wife to bring into their home children with whom they had no biological relationship. By the time Gregory reappeared with a tray, Strike's thoughts had travelled to Charlotte, who had always declared herself entirely unmaternal, and whose premature twins she'd vowed, while pregnant, to abandon to the care of her mother-in-law.
"Would you mind shifting?"
Gregory asked, eyes on the coffee table. Strike hastened to move handfuls of objects off it onto the sofa.
"Cheers,"
said Gregory, setting down the tray. He scooped yet another mound of objects off the second armchair, dumped them too, onto the now considerable pile on the sofa, picked up his mug, sat down and said,
"Help yourself,"
indicating a slightly sticky sugar bowl and an unopened packet of biscuits.
"Thanks very much," said Strike,
spooning sugar into his tea.
"So," said Gregory, looking mildly excited, "you're trying to prove Creed killed Margot Bamborough?"
"Well," said Strike, "I'm trying to find out what happened to her, and one possibility, obviously, is Creed."
"Did you see in the paper last weekend one of Creed's drawings selling for over $1,000?
"Missed that," said Strike.
"Yeah, it was in the Observer. Self-portrait in pencil, done when he was in Belmarsh. Sold on a website where you can buy serial killer art. Crazy world."
"It is," agreed Strike.
"Well, as I said on the phone, what I'd really like to talk to you about is your father."
"Yes,"
said Gregory, and some of his jauntiness left him.
I don't know how much you know."
"That he took early retirement following a breakdown."
"Well, yes, that's it in a nutshell," said Gregory. "His thyroid was at the bottom of it, overactive and undiagnosed for ages. He was losing weight, not sleeping. There was a lot of pressure on him, you know, not just from the force, the press as well. People were very upset. Well, you know, a missing doctor. Mum put him acting a bit oddly down to stress."
"In what way was he acting oddly?"
"Well, he took over the spare room and wouldn't let anyone in there," said Gregory. And before Strike could ask for more details, he continued, "After they found out about his thyroid and got him on the right drugs, he went back to normal. But it was too late for his career. He got his pension, but he felt guilty about the Bamborough case for years. He blamed himself, you know, thinking that if he hadn't been so ill, he might have got him. because Margot Bamborough wasn't the last woman Cree took. I suppose you'll know all about that. He abducted Andrea Hooton after he took Bamborough. When they arrested him and went into the house and saw what was in the basement, the torture equipment and the photos he'd taken of the women, he admitted he'd kept some of them alive for months before he killed them. Dad was really upset when he heard that. He kept going back over it in his head, thinking if he'd caught him earlier, Bamborough and Hooton might have still been alive. He beat himself up for getting fixated. Gregory cut himself off. Distracted, you know. So even once your father had recovered, he still thought Creed had taken Margot. Oh, yeah, definitely, said Gregory, looking mildly surprised that this was in question. They ruled out all the other possibilities, didn't they? The ex-boyfriend, that dodgy patient who had a thing for her, they all came up clean. Rather than answering this with his honest view, which was that Talbot's unfortunate illness had allowed valuable months to pass in which all suspects, Creed included, had had time to hide a body, cover up evidence, refine their alibis, or all three, Strike took from an inside pocket the piece of paper on which Talbot had written his Pitman message and held it out to Gregory.
"Wanted to ask you about something. I think that's your father's handwriting."
"Where did you get this?" asked Gregory, taking the paper cautiously.
"From the police file. It says, 'And that is the last of them, the 12th, and the circle will be closed upon finding the 10th. And then there's an unknown word, Baphomet. Transcribe in the true book," said Strike. "And I was wondering whether that meant anything to you."
At that moment, there came a particularly loud crash from overhead. With a hasty "excuse me," Gregory laid the paper on top of the tea tray and hurried from the room. Strike heard him climbing the stairs, and then a telling off. It appeared that one of the twins had overturned a chest of drawers. Soprano voices united in exculpation and counter-accusation. Through the net curtains, Strike now saw an old Volvo pulling up outside the house. A plump, middle-aged brunette in a navy raincoat got out, followed by two boys, whom he guessed to be around 14 or 15. The woman went to the boot of the car and took out two sports bags and several bags of shopping from Aldi. The boys, who'd begun to slouch towards the house, had to be called back to assist her. Gregory arrived back at the sitting room door just as his wife entered the hall. One of the teenage boys shoved his way past Gregory to survey the stranger with the amazement appropriate to spotting an escaped zoo animal.
"Hi," said Strike.
The boy turned in astonishment to Gregory.
"Who's he?"
he asked, pointing. The second boy appeared beside the first, eyeing Strike with precisely the same mixture of wonder and suspicion.
"This is Mr. Strike," said Gregory.
His wife now appeared between the boys, placed a hand on their shoulders, and steered them bodily away, smiling at Strike as she did so. Gregory closed the door behind him and returned to his armchair. He appeared to have momentarily forgotten what he and Strike had been talking about before he had gone upstairs, but then his eye fell upon the piece of paper, scrawled all over with his father's handwriting, dotted with pentagrams and with the cryptic lines in Pitman shorthand.
"Do you know why Dad knew Pitman shorthand?" he said, with forced cheerfulness. "My mother was learning it at Secretarial College, so he learned it as well, so he could test her. He was a good husband, and a good dad, too," he added, a little defiantly.
"Sounds it," said Strike.
There was another pause.
"Look," said Gregory, "they kept the specifics of Dad's illness out of the press at the time. He was a good copper, and it wasn't his fault he got ill. My mother's still alive. She'd be devastated if it all got out now."
"I can appreciate—"
"Actually, I'm not sure you can," said Gregory, flushing slightly. He seemed a polite and mild man, and it was clear that this assertive statement cost him some effort. "The families of some of Creed's victims afterwards, there was a lot of ill feeling towards Dad. They blamed him for not getting Creed, for screwing it all up. People wrote to the house telling him he was a disgrace. Mum and Dad ended up moving. From what you said on the phone, I thought you were interested in Dad's theories, not in stuff like that, he said, gesturing at the pentagram-strewn paper.
I'm very interested in your father's theories, said Strike.
Deciding that a little duplicity was called for, or at least a little reframing of the facts, the detective added,
Most of what your father wrote in the case file is entirely sound. He was asking all the right questions, and he noticed the speeding van, said Gregory quickly. Exactly, said Strike.
Rainy night, exactly like when Vera Kenny and Gail Reitman were abducted.
Right, said Strike, nodding.
The two women who were struggling together, said Gregory. That last patient, the woman who looked like a man. I mean, you've got to admit, you add all that together.
This is what I'm talking about, said Strike. He might have been ill, but he still knew a clue when he saw one. All I want to know is whether the shorthand means anything I should know about.
Some of Gregory's excitement faded from his face. No, he said. It doesn't. That's just his illness talking.
You know, said Strike slowly, your father wasn't the only one who saw Creed as satanic. The title of the best biography of him.
The Demon of Paradise Park.
Exactly. Creed and Baphomet have a lot in common, said Strike.
In the pause that followed, they heard the twins running downstairs and loudly asking their foster mother whether she'd bought chocolate mousse.
Look, I'd love you to prove it was Creed, said Gregory at last. Prove Dad was right all along. There'd be no shame in Creed being too clever for him. He was too clever for Lawson as well. He's been too clever for everyone. I know there wasn't any sign of Margot Bamborough in Creed's basement, but he never revealed where he'd put Andrea Hooton's clothes and jewellery either. He was varying the way he disposed of bodies at the end. He was unlucky with Hooton, chucking her off the cliffs. Unlucky the body was found so quickly.
All true, said Strike.
Strike drank his tea while Gregory absent-mindedly chewed off a hangnail. A full minute passed before Strike decided that further pressure was required.
This business about transcribing in the true book.
He knew by Gregory's slight start that he'd hit the bullseye.
I wondered whether your father kept separate records from the official file, and if so, said Strike, when Gregory didn't answer, whether they're still in existence.
Gregory's wondering gaze fixed itself once more on Strike.
Yeah, all right, he said. Dad thought he was looking for something supernatural. We didn't know that until near the end, until we realized how ill he was. He was sprinkling salt outside our bedroom doors every night to keep out Baphomet. He'd made himself what Mum thought was a home office in the spare room, but he was keeping the door locked. The night he was sectioned, said Gregory, looking miserable, he came running out of it, shouting. He woke us all up. My brother and I came out onto the landing. Dad had left the door to the spare room open, and we saw pentagrams all over the walls and lit candles. He'd taken up the carpet and made a magic circle on the floor to perform some kind of ritual. And he claimed, well, he thought he'd conjured some kind of demonic creature. Mum called 999 and an ambulance came and... Well, you know the rest.
Must have been very distressing for all of you, said Strike.
Well, yeah, it was.
While Dad was in hospital, Mum cleaned out the room, took away his tarot cards and all the occult books, and painted over the pentagrams and the magic circle. It was all the more upsetting for her because both had been committed churchgoers before Dad had his breakdown.
He was clearly very ill, said Strike, which wasn't his fault, but he was still a detective and he still had sound copper sense. I can see it in the official record. If there's another set of records anywhere, especially if it contains stuff that isn't in the official file, it's an important document.
Gregory chewed his nail again, looking tense. Finally, he seemed to reach a decision. Ever since we spoke on the phone, I've been thinking that maybe I should give you this, he said, standing up and heading over to an overflowing bookcase in the corner. From the top, he took a large leather-bound notebook of old-fashioned type which had a cord wrapped round it. This was the only thing that didn't get thrown away, said Gregory, looking down at the notebook, because Dad wouldn't let go of it when the ambulance arrived. He said he had to record what the, spirit had looked like, the thing he'd conjured, so the notebook got taken to hospital with him. They let him draw the demon, which helped the doctors understand what had been going on in his head, because at first he didn't want to talk to them. I found all this out afterwards. They protected me and my brother from it while it was going on. After Dad got well, he kept the notebook, because he said if anything was a reminder to take his medicine, this was it. But I wanted to meet you before I made a decision. Resisting the urge to hold out his hand, Strike sat trying to look as sympathetic as his naturally surly features would allow. Robin was far better at conveying warmth and empathy. He'd watched her persuading recalcitrant witnesses many times since they'd gone into business together. "You understand," said Gregory, still clutching the notebook, and evidently determined to hammer the point home. "He'd had a complete mental breakdown."
"Of course," said Strike. "Who else have you shown that to?"
"Nobody," said Gregory. "It's been up in our attic for the last 10 years. We had a couple of boxes of stuff from Mum and Dad's old house up there. Funny, you turning up just as the loft was being mucked out. Maybe this is all Dad's doing. Maybe he's trying to tell me it's okay to pass this over." Strike made an ambiguous noise designed to convey agreement that the Talbots' decision to clear out their loft had been somehow prompted by Gregory's dead father, rather than the need to accommodate 2 extra children. "Take it," said Gregory abruptly, holding out the old notebook. Strike thought he looked relieved to see it pass into someone else's possession.
"I appreciate your trust. If I find anything in here I think you can help with, would it be all right to contact you again?"
"Yes, of course," said Gregory. "You've got my email address. I'll give you my mobile number." 5 minutes later, Strike was standing in the hall, shaking hands with Mrs. Talbot as he prepared to return to his office. "Lovely to meet you," she said. "I'm glad he's given you that thing. You never know, do you?" And with the notebook in his hand, Strike agreed that you never did.
Chapter 18. So the fair Britomart, having disclosed her cloudy care into a wrathful stour, the mist of grief dissolved. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Robin, who'd recently given up many weekends to cover the agency's workload, took the following Tuesday and Wednesday off at Strike's insistence. Her suggestion that she come into the office to look at the notebook Gregory Talbot had given Strike, and to go systematically through the last box of the police file, which neither of them had yet had time to examine, had been sternly vetoed by the senior partner. Strike knew there was no time left this year for Robin to take all the leave she was owed, but he was determined that she should take as much as she could. However, if Strike imagined that Robin derived much pleasure from her days off, he was wrong. She spent Tuesday dealing with mundanities such as laundry and food shopping, and on Wednesday morning set off for a twice-postponed appointment with her solicitor. When she'd broken the news to her parents that she and Matthew were to divorce a little over a year after they'd married, her mother and father had wanted her to use a solicitor in Harrogate, who was an old family friend.
"I live in London. Why would I use a law firm in Yorkshire?"
Robin had chosen a lawyer in her late 40s called Judith, whose dry humour, spiky grey hair, and thick, black-rimmed glasses had endeared her to Robin when they first met. Robin's feeling of warmth had abated somewhat over the ensuing 12 months. It was hard to maintain fondness for the person whose job it was to pass on the latest intransigent and aggressive communications from Matthew's lawyer. As the months rolled past, Robin noticed that Judith occasionally forgot or misremembered information pertinent to the divorce. Robin, who always took care to give her own clients the impression that their concerns were uppermost in her mind at all times, couldn't help wondering whether Judith would have been more meticulous if Robin had been richer. Like Robin's parents, Judith had initially assumed that this divorce would be quick and easy, a matter of two signatures and a handshake. The couple had been married a little over a year, and there were no children, not even a pet to argue over. Robin's parents had gone so far as to imagine that Matthew, whom they'd known since he was a child, must feel such shame at his infidelity that he'd want to compensate Robin by being generous and reasonable over the divorce. Her mother's growing fury towards her ex-son-in-law was starting to make Robin dread her phone calls home. The offices of Sterling and Cobbs were a 20-minute walk away from Robin's flat on North End Road. Zipping herself into a warm coat, umbrella in hand, Robin chose to walk that morning purely for the exercise, because she'd spent so many long hours in her car of late, sitting outside the weatherman's house, waiting for postcard. Indeed, the last time she'd walked for a whole hour had been inside the National Portrait Gallery, a trip that had been fruitless, except for one tiny incident that Robin had discounted, because Strike had taught her to mistrust the hunches so romanticised by the non-investigative public, which, he said, were more often than not born of personal biases or wishful thinking. Tired, dispirited, and knowing full well that nothing she was about to hear from Judith was likely to cheer her up, Robin was passing a bookies when her mobile rang. Extracting it from her pocket took a little longer than usual, because she was wearing gloves, and she consequently sounded a little panicky when she finally managed to answer the unknown number.
Yes, hello? Robin Ellicott speaking.
Oh, hi, this is Eden Richards.
For a moment, Robin couldn't for the life of her think who Eden Richards was. The woman on the end of the line seemed to divine her dilemma, because she continued,
Wilma Bayliss's daughter. You sent me and my brothers and sisters messages. You wanted to talk to us about Margot Bamborough.
Oh, yes, of course, thank you for calling me back, said Robin,
backing into the bookie's doorway, her finger in the ear not pressed against the phone to block out the sound of traffic. Eden, she now remembered, was the oldest of Wilma's offspring, a Labour councillor from Lewisham.
Yeah, said Eden Richards. Well, I'm afraid we don't want to talk to you. And I'm speaking for all of us here, okay?
I'm sorry to hear that, said Robin, watching abstractedly as a passing Doberman pincher squatted and defecated on the pavement while its scowling owner waited, a plastic bag hanging from his hand.
Can I ask why?
We just don't want to, said Eden. Okay?
Okay, said Robin. But to be clear, all we're doing is checking statements that were made around the time Margot. We can't speak for our mother, said Eden. She's dead. We feel sorry for Margot's daughter, but we don't want to drag up stuff that... It's something we don't particularly want to relive, any of our family. We were young when she disappeared. It was a bad time for us, so the answer's no. Okay?
I understand, said Robin. But I wish you'd reconsider. We aren't asking you to talk about anything, but
you are, though, said Eden.
Yeah, you are.
And we don't want to, okay? You aren't police. And by the way, my youngest sister's going through chemotherapy, so leave her alone, please. She doesn't need the grief. I'm going to go now. The answer's no, okay? Don't contact any of us again, please.
And the line went dead. Shit, said Robin out loud. The owner of the Doberman Pinscher, who was now scooping a sizable pile of that very substance off the pavement, said,
You and me both, love.
Robin forced a smile, stuffed her mobile back into her pocket and walked on. Shortly afterwards, still wondering whether she could have handled the call with Eden better, Robin pushed open the glass door of Sterling and Cobbs, solicitors.
Well, said Judith 5 minutes later, once Robin was sitting opposite her in the tiny office full of filing cabinets.
The monosyllable was followed by silence as Judith glanced over the documents in the file in front of her, clearly reminding herself of the facts of the case while Robin sat watching. Robin would much rather have sat for another 5 minutes in the waiting room than witness this casual and hasty revision of what was causing her so much stress and pain.
Said Judith. Yes, just checking that, yes. We had a response to ours on the 14th, as I said in my email, so you'll be aware that Mr. Cunliffe isn't prepared to shift his position on the joint account.
Yes, said Robin.
So I really think it's time to go to mediation, said Judith Cobbs.
And as I said in my reply to your email, said Robin, wondering whether Judith had read it, I can't see mediation working.
Which is why I wanted to speak to you face to face, said Judith, smiling.
We often find that when the two parties have to sit down in the same room and answer for themselves, especially with impartial witnesses present, I'd be with you, obviously, they become far less intransigent than they are by letter.
You said yourself, Robin replied.
Blood was thumping in her ears. The sensation of not being heard was becoming increasingly common during these interactions.
The last time we met, you agreed that Matthew seems to be trying to force this into court. He isn't really interested in the joint account. He can outspend me 10 times over. He just wants to beat me. He wants a judge to agree that I married him for his bank account. He'll think it money well spent if he can point to some ruling that says the divorce was all my fault.
It's easy, said Judith, still smiling, to attribute the worst possible motives to ex-partners. But he's clearly an intelligent. Intelligent people can be as spiteful as anyone else.
True, said Judith, still with an air of humouring Robin. But refusing to even try mediation is a bad move for both of you. No judge will look kindly on anyone who refuses to at least try and settle matters without recourse to the courts.
The truth, as perhaps Judith and Robin both equally knew, was that Robin dreaded having to sit face to face with Matthew and the lawyer who had authored all those cold, threatening letters.
I've told him I don't want the inheritance he got from his mother, said Robin. All I want back out of that joint account is the money my parents put into our first property.
Yes, said Judith, with a hint of boredom. Robin knew that she'd said exactly this every time they'd met each other.
But as you're aware, his position is that I contributed virtually nothing to our finances, so he ought to keep the whole lot, because he went into the marriage out of love, and I'm some kind of gold digger.
This is obviously upsetting you, said Judith, no longer smiling.
We were together 10 years, said Robin, trying with little success to remain calm. When he was a student and I was working, I paid for everything. Should I have kept the receipts?
We can certainly make that point in mediation.
That'll just infuriate him, said Robin.
She raised a hand to her face, purely for the purpose of hiding it. She felt suddenly and perilously close to tears.
Okay, fine. We can try mediation.
I think that's the sensible thing to do, said Judith Cobbs, smiling again. So I'll contact Brophy, Shenstone, and I suppose I'll get a chance to tell Matthew he's a total shit at least, said Robin, on a sudden wave of fury.
Judith gave a small laugh.
Oh, I wouldn't advise that, she said.
Oh, wouldn't you really, thought Robin, as she hitched on another fake smile and got up to leave.
A blustery damp wind was blowing when she left the solicitor's. Robin trudged back towards Finborough Road, until finally, her face numb, her hair whipping into her eyes, she turned into a small cafe where, in defiance of her own healthy eating rules, she bought a large latte and a chocolate brownie. She sat and stared out at the rain-swept street, enjoying the comfort of cake and coffee, until her mobile rang again. It was Strike.
Hi, she said, through a mouthful of brownie. Sorry. Eating.
Wish I was, he said. I'm outside the bloody theatre again. I think Barclay's right. We're not going to get anything on Twinkle Toes.